Good morning. Everyone alert? I see that you found this place. I had a little difficulty getting here myself. Well, good morning. My name is Scott Bennett. I'm a director of congressional relations for American Farm Bureau, and I have the pleasure of introducing our panel this morning. For the sake of time, our introductions will be short, but welcome to Fake Meat, Passing Fad, or the Future of Food. Our speakers are Leah McGrath. Leah McGrath is a registered dietitian nutritionist who's worked in retail, public health, and the military as a dietitian for the past 25 years. In addition, we have Mr. Eric Mittenthal. Mr. Mittenthal is a vice president of public affairs at the North American Meat Institute, previously serving in this role at the American Meat Institute. He leads their communication efforts on behalf of the organization, including mainstream and social media outreach. And last but not least, we also have Ms. Hannah Thompson-Wieman, who serves as the Vice President of Communications for the Animal Agriculture Institute. So with that, I will turn it over to our panel. Thank you for being here this morning.
Good morning. Happy National Pastrami Day. Did you know that it was National Pastrami Day today? We're very excited for that. There are no alternative pastramis that I'm aware of. So we're talking about real meat pastrami. So, well, thank you to Scott for the introduction. And we're going to talk about a key issue right now. And I think we want to start off with a little bit of nomenclature. The session is called Fake Meat, but there's a lot of different ways that these new products are referred to, whether that be fake meat, alternative sources of protein, plant-based proteins, clean meat is a term that's out there. Some of the terminology is somewhat divisive, I think. That's one of the challenges in terms of the way these products have been communicated about. Certainly from a meat industry perspective, the term clean meat is something that we consider inaccurate and inappropriate. I know there are very strong feelings on their side of the coin regarding the term fake meat. So in the interest of being cordial, I tend to use alternative proteins, alternative products, and kind of keep it in the middle there and not get too much into the weeds on the names and stirring things up that way. When we're talking about these alternative products, we're talking about a couple of different types, and a lot of people get confused about this, but there's actually two completely different types of products that are out there with a similar goal. One is you have plant-based meats, and these are products that are specifically made from plants to mimic meat. And then you have cell-based meat, which is actually grown from animal cells into what they say is meat. There are a number of different companies, very little overlap between the companies. There is one company, Just, which overlaps and does both types of products, but for the most part, you're kind of either in one camp or the other with them. They do have a common theme, and that is the goal of attracting meat eaters. So what they are trying to, their audience is not the traditional vegan, vegetarian looking for different types of products. They want to compete in the meat case with meat products, and they want their audience and their purchasers to be meat eaters. And a lot of them come from Silicon Valley, and they consider themselves disruptors, kind of a Silicon Valley mindset, where they're trying to disrupt traditional meat production and meat consumption. And they are looking at it from a perspective of environmental impact, animal welfare, and nutrition. And there's a lot of rhetoric out there regarding those, and not all of that's accurate, but those are certainly the areas that those companies tend to be focused on. Like I said, they both want to be competing directly. You'll find these products directly in the meat case next to traditional products if they're sold at retail, or they're on the menus in the same section as hamburgers at restaurants. So I want to walk through some of the different products that are out there, kind of give you an idea of some of the most common ones that you'll find, and then we'll talk a little bit about the regulatory element of it as well and kind of where that's headed. Because for the Meat Institute, that's kind of where the focus is really, our interest is the regulation to make sure that they are regulated appropriately and that there's an even playing field. So one of them that you've probably heard the most about is Beyond Meat. They make the Beyond Burger, which is available at retail, and they also make a sausage product as well. It's a pea protein-based product, and for the most part, they're retail-focused. You'll find them in your grocery stores, and they also have expanded into food service as well. The Beyond Burger is available at TGI Fridays around the country. They have some pretty big name investors, Bill Gates, Leonardo DiCaprio, the Humane Society of the US, as well as Tyson. And they are aiming, I can't recall if they've specifically done their IPO yet, but they are aiming to go public this year. So they have grown to the point where they can become a public company. The other major player on the plant-based side that has gotten a lot of attention is Impossible Foods. And you may have heard of the Impossible Burger, which is primarily available in restaurants. That is made from wheat, coconut oil, potatoes, and a product called soy leg hemoglobin, which is their way of making heme iron, which gives traditional meat its kind of meaty taste. And they have they've come up with a way to get that out of yeast through a GMO process to add that to their burgers, and that certainly generated a little bit of controversy within that. Their investors include Bill Gates and many venture capital funds, and interestingly, they just debuted their version 2.0 at the Consumer Electronics Show, of all places, this past week, to rave reviews, actually, and they are aiming to move that version into retail coming this year as well. So there's a very high likelihood you'll start seeing some of the Impossible Burgers on your grocery store shelves as well. One of the most interesting elements of the Impossible Burger is that they are now available at White Castle restaurants, and along with the traditional White Castle sliders. And it's interesting the way people respond to these products. One review out there on the White Castle version said it's one of the best, America's best fast food burgers. Another review that I saw said it's the possible worst burger ever. Why so different? In my experience, when you're looking at these products and kind of the way people are communicating about them, is that if you want to love them, you will. If you want to hate them, you will. Having tasted them, I can say that there's a reason why there's a version 2.0. I have not tasted that version yet, but I do think they still have some work to do there. So the other products, category of products is cell-based meat products. And these are a little bit different than those plant-based products, and I'll talk a little bit about that. They're grown from real animal cells. This slide says it costs $18,000 to produce a pound of beef. We heard from the folks at one of the companies last week, they said they're down to about $1,000 a pound, which certainly is far more expensive than anyone will ever pay for a pound of ground beef or a hamburger. But the point is, they are coming down to the point where at some point it will be affordable, but they're certainly not there yet. And I think they're aiming for around 2021, 2022 to have products out there. Some of them are a little faster track than that. And those cells are grown in a bioreactor. So they are taking them, putting them into a bioreactor similar to how beer is fermented, and developing the cells that way. Memphis Meats is the major player, I think, on that market at this point. To date, I should mention, nobody has tried any of the cell-based products, unless you're associated with one of the companies or you happen to be a very select member of the media or venture capital fund who has been able to try them. So when you hear that they're the next great thing, that everybody loves them, nobody's tried them, so it's kind of hard to make that judgment at this point. Memphis Meats is focused on beef, chicken, and duck products. Is their first products that'll make it to the market. They estimate 2021, and their investors include Bill Gates, Richard Branson, similar names as some of the other products as well as Cargill and Tyson. So they certainly have some inroads into the meat industry, and some of the major players have invested in Memphis Meats. The other major company out there is called Just. If you've heard of the company Hampton Creek, they made plant-based mayo, still do, but they changed their company name just last year to Just. They claimed last year that they were going to have a chicken product on the marketplace last year. That did not happen, so they are aiming for this year for that. If there is a product that they are able to put on the marketplace within the next year, it likely will not be in the U.S. As the U.S. regulatory scheme has not been fully developed for that yet. And it'll only be available at probably high-end restaurants or with chefs that they're specifically working with, as it's too expensive right now to put into a mainstream setting. They made a new investment, which is interesting, and I don't know how it'll play out, but just this within the last few weeks, they announced they're making cell-based Wagyu beef. So they've teamed with a farm in Japan that produces Wagyu beef, and they're taking cells from those animals, and they're aiming to use those cells to grow steaks. Whether or not that will actually succeed as something is still a question, but that's their next step. And it's interesting when you look at their website these days. Last year it was all about the chicken. Now it is all about the Wagyu beef. So I don't know as a company they're changing directions a little bit, but that's become their focus more so, it seems, than the chicken. They do say they're aiming to work with meat companies for distribution. I don't know of any specific deals they have available or completed as far as that's concerned, but that's something that they're aiming to do. And then there are a lot of international players on the market when it comes to these products. You have several in Israel. Most of the meat is based in the Netherlands. And China has been investing in these products as well. And so I think, you know, even if they're not necessarily coming to the U.S. immediately, there will be these products available on the international marketplace eventually as well. And I found this headline interesting. One of the Israeli companies debuted the first lab-grown steak. And the headline was, it tastes 70% as 70% like real meat and could be in restaurants in 2 years, and it'll cost you $50 a steak. Everybody's dream, right? So I thought that was interesting. Certainly not necessarily the headline that I think they're interested in, but it shows that they are on track and will have products in the marketplace in the near future. So from our perspective, the regulatory status is kind of really where our primary focus has been and determining how these products are being regulated. Because there certainly is a difference between USDA and FDA regulatory schemes. And if a product wants to be called meat, from our perspective, it should be regulated as meat, which for us means USDA regulation. Now, there were a lot of discussions kind of going on behind the scenes in D.C. A couple years ago regarding these, not much action. That all changed last winter when the U.S. Cattlemen's Association submitted a petition to USDA asking to exclude products not derived from animals raised and slaughtered from the definition of beef and meat. And this was something that generated a lot of attention. It was not something that at the Meat Institute and other major meat groups supported for a couple of reasons. First of all, meat is defined by USDA already, has been for many years. To change that definition opens up a big can of worms on a lot of other issues. And we felt like the definition of meat is pretty clear, it works. There's no need to change that specifically related to these products. The other element is that if it was redefined in the way the petition requests, that definition would exclude it from being regulated by USDA, which, again, is a problem. And why is that a problem? Have you looked in your milk case recently? FDA does not regulate products and claims of products in the same way that FSIS, USDA, does. Certainly, if you've seen in your milk case, alongside traditional milk, you find all kinds of plant-based milks. Some people call them plant-based waters. There's a lot of different ways to categorize them, but certainly there's been a lot of headaches about the way that some of the new plant-based products have entered into the milk case and allow themselves to be called milk. And it's happening with some of the plant-based products. These are actual products that are on the marketplace, and these are made by Tofurky, which certainly for those in the industry know that that's a plant-based product. But for an average person going into the grocery store and seeing that package, odds are you're going to think that's a sausage. And the only way to know that it's not a meat-based sausage is in tiny, tiny print on there, it says it's vegan. And not only that, but Italian sausage, bratwurst, they have an andouille sausage, those all have USDA standards of identity, meaning there are specific definitions of what those products are, and those definitions say those products are made of meat. To date, nothing's been done about that, but we've raised some issues, we've raised questions about these, we've certainly alerted both agencies about the way these products are being marketed, and we feel like that's inappropriate to try to mislead consumers in that way. And so that brings us to our position that USDA should assert jurisdiction over the cell-based products. Now, the plant-based products, I think, is pretty clear. It has to be FDA regulated. They're not meat. But we also believe that USDA and FDA should work together to ensure that those are being marketed appropriately and not passed off as meat products, as they are not meat products. And certainly they should avoid claims to disparage meat products as well. we were very much kind of in DC headed towards a potential scheme where it was going to be, FDA was pushing very hard to regulate the cell-based products. But we had a game changer that happened in the summer, where we signed a letter with Memphis Meats in conjunction with them pushing for USDA regulation. Memphis Meats came to us, said, you know what, we agree that USDA should be regulating these products. We sent a letter to President Trump, and USDA and FDA coming together and saying that they will jointly regulate the products. Now, the framework of what actually that looks like is still to be determined. And so there's a lot of devil in the details, nuance out there that we have to learn a little bit more about before we can fully understand exactly what they have in mind for that. But we're headed in the direction where products that are going into the marketplace will be regulated by USDA as we think is most appropriate. And then I'll close with there are some other legislative efforts going on regarding these products. You may have heard that the state of Missouri has passed a law that regulates them, and the Missouri law says that products cannot be marketed as meat unless it comes from an animal with 2 or 4 feet. And so that specifically excludes the plant-based and cell-based products from being marketed as meat. I do know that as legislative sessions around the country in different states have started up, there are other states that are considering these types of laws. I believe Wyoming or Montana was one of them. I believe there's one in Virginia as well where we are. And so I think we will see other states with interest in pursuing this. The one note to keep in mind, particularly as it relates to cell-based products, if USDA regulates it, then they are federally preempted. So USDA has to approve all labels that go into the marketplace. And so if those products are USDA regulated, state laws will be preempted, won't apply as the federal law applies in those cases. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Hannah to talk a little bit more about the concerns and considerations.
Good morning, and I'll echo again the appreciation to all of you for coming out here bright and early. There's a lot going on, so you guys are the real MVPs for sticking it out and making it out to hang out with us this morning and talk about a pretty interesting topic. I'm curious, how many of you have read some kind of article or saw something on social media or heard something on the news that talked about lab-grown meat and how it is going to revolutionize the food supply and we're all going to be eating it? How many people have seen? Yeah, almost everyone in here. That's a lot of noise and a lot of conversation about a product that, as Eric noted, no one's eaten it. It's not available for purchase. So what I'm going to talk through this morning is who are some of the other players in the game? It's not just the companies that are producing these products that are talking about them. There are some other organizations out there that have a vested interest in promoting alternatives to meat and decreases in real meat consumption. And I think it's important for us to understand who those groups are, what kind of messaging they're using, so we can make sure we're correcting any myths and misinformation that's out there. If you're not familiar with the organization I'm with, the Animal Agriculture Alliance, we are a nonprofit and our mission is to bridge the communication gap between farm and fork. So everything that we do is about monitoring issues, keeping an eye on activist organizations, informing the animal agriculture industry, and ultimately speaking with a united voice on behalf of issues that could impact all of us and our ability to do business and consumers' confidence in our products. Farm Bureau is a member of ours. Scott, who introduced us, is actually on our board of directors. And American Farm Bureau Federation was one of our founding members back in 1987, and they've been a member of the Alliance for over 30 years. We have a lot of state farm bureaus that are involved as well. So on behalf of the Alliance, I appreciate all of the involvement from Farm Bureau. We'd love to talk to you about additional resources or anything. We have a booth in the trade show, 413, I believe. We're right next to AARP, so make of that what you will. So definitely come by this afternoon and chat with our team if we've intrigued you with anything we discussed today. So as I mentioned, for my portion of the conversation, I'm going to talk through who some of the voices are out there talking about this that we should be keeping an eye on. What are some potential areas of concern for animal agriculture? And then ultimately some action items for you, because coming here at 7:45 was not enough. We have more that we want you to do. As I mentioned, there are a large number of extremely strategic, extremely aggressive, and extremely well-funded organizations who are opposed to animal agriculture. These groups are not focused on animal welfare. They are not looking at animal well-being. From their perspective, there is no way that we could raise animals that is ethical and that is responsible. So that is their end goal. That is their focus, is ending meat consumption, putting farmers and ranchers out of business, or I guess everyone can start growing almonds and soybeans. But they do not believe that there's any way that humans can eat meat in a way that, again, is responsible and has the health and welfare of animals in mind. So with that, a big part of their agenda is encouraging people to reduce and ultimately eliminate their meat consumption. You do not have to just take my word for it. We have some quotes here from several activist groups. Eric already referenced the Humane Society of the United States. They actually have a 15-member meatless transition team. So they have 15 full-time staff members whose job it is to encourage restaurants, food service companies to serve less meat, and to encourage schools and other institutions to go to Meatless Mondays, which is just a doorway to meatless every day. To put that in a little bit of perspective, the Alliance has 5 full-time staff members. So they have 3 times our staff just focused on transitioning away from eating meat. You can see some of the reason for that here. If we want to put an end to factory farming, we have to reduce the amount of meat being eaten. Again, factory farming, quote unquote, is a pejorative term they use to refer to farms over an arbitrary size. It doesn't really have any kind of real definition. They know we can eliminate the demand for meat from Paul Shapiro. We'll touch on him a little bit more later. Humane meat, there is no such thing. And eating meat is unethical, from someone with the Good Food Institute, who we'll also circle back to. So for these organizations, meat alternatives are positioned as a solution to the need that they feel, they perceive, that exists to end animal agriculture. I'm going to talk through some of these organizations here. I just referenced the Good Food Institute. They were founded in 2015 as a sister organization to Mercy for Animals, who is, again, a very aggressive animal rights activist organization. Their mission is to work to promote these products, both plant-based and lab-grown. They have members that are the companies that do produce these products. And the part I want to call your attention to in their mission is this bolded statement that says they focus on cultured and plant-based meat, milk, and eggs, products that are more delicious, safer to eat, and better for the planet than their outdated counterparts. And that is talking about the milk, meat, poultry, and eggs that you all produce. They believe it is outdated and that their product is inherently superior. Their executive director, Bruce Friedrich, used to be with PETA. Again, very clear animal rights activist organization. He's also with Farm Sanctuary. And they have several current and former Humane Society employees either on staff or on their advisory council. So, if you go to their website and read their bios, Bruce Friedrich's bio makes no mention of his connection to PETA and other very extreme groups. This organization wants to position themselves as, again, a science-based, forward-thinking organization without talking about the fact that their real agenda is replacement and abolition of animal agriculture. And as I mentioned, they've got a lot of money to do that. There's an organization called the Open Philanthropy Project. It was founded by one of the founders of Facebook, so he has a lot of money. And they've made animal causes kind of a pet project, if you pardon the pun. And the Good Food Institute has received $2.5 million in grants from that organization in operating funds. So again, that's a lot more money than we have at the Alliance. That's a lot more money than a lot of animal ag organizations have to talk positively about the industry. And that funding is a big reason why we hear so much about these products, because there's a lot of push going on to promote them. We talked about some of the messaging they're using and how negative it is towards animal agriculture. Notice these tweets are not promoting cultured meat or plant-based meat. They're not saying anything positive about their product. They're focused on disparaging what we produce. They talk about the rise of industrial animal agriculture and all of the problems it has led to, and how plant-based and clean meat, as Eric touched on earlier, why that might not be the best term we want to use, can solve these problems. They also talk about cutting back on conventional meat is necessary to curb climate change and fix our broken food system. And then they talk about their product as the way to do that. So again, very negative messaging about animal agriculture is used in the promotion of these products. There's also a relatively new organization, the Plant-Based Foods Association. It was founded in 2016. They again promote plant-based products, and they're kind of a trade association for companies that produce them. Their executive director, Michelle Simon, is a public health lawyer, and you can see some quotes here that tell you her perspective on animal agriculture. If you eat industrially produced pork, you are supporting a dirty, cruel, and corrupt business. Horrendous conditions in bird factories, reference there, talking about the poultry industry. So again, very negative, very inflammatory rhetoric about animal agriculture from these organizations. And we've casually chatted before, you know, you can, this eating more vegetables is never a bad thing. I work for the Animal Agriculture Alliance, and I would absolutely never say about the horrendous conditions on lettuce factories and how unsafe plants are for us to eat. There's room for everyone at the table, room for everyone on the plate, and it's just really not necessary to be so negative. I mentioned earlier Paul Shapiro. He was a longtime employee of the Humane Society of the United States, and he has left there to really focus on promoting these products, these cultured meat products. He came out with a book about a year ago, the beginning of 2018, called Clean Meat: How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. And according to him, cultured meat is safer, more eco-friendly, and more humane than traditional meat. And throughout the book, he talks about animal welfare, environmental sustainability, food safety, and tries to make a lot of very bold claims about how these products, which again, keep in mind, they have not been produced at scale, they are not publicly available for consumption, there are a lot of unknowns about what the inputs and impacts will be of producing these products at scale, but that doesn't stop these organizations from using some of their very extreme messaging. So I think it's pretty clear what some of the concerns are for animal agriculture, but something that I really want to make sure we all keep in mind is that the mere existence of these products and them being out there for consumers as an option, that's not the issue. Consumers having more options in the grocery store, having more ability to find what fits their values, their budgets, that's something we really advocate for at the Alliance. Our concern is how these products are promoted and how they're marketed. So I think for all of you, that's the place we all need to be directing our energy, is not on disparaging or making jokes or anything about the fact that these products exist, but really thinking about how they're positioned to our customers and how we need to correct anything out there that is not accurate. So there's usually three core messages that these groups use in promoting their products. And again, it's interesting, a lot of times it's more so the associations, so the activist groups we've touched on today, versus the companies themselves. As Eric referenced, they've had some good collaborative conversations with some of the companies involved in here. But really it's these three core areas that they focus on: the environmental impact of meat production, health concerns that they believe are connected to eating meat, and what they believe are the ethical concerns of eating meat. This is an example of some of the messaging that we're up against, and I promise I went and searched for this after I put the other slide together, but right here in the seven reasons that Mercy for Animals wants us to go vegan this year, right here, three out of those seven are the issues I just touched upon. The environment: they say the animal agriculture industry is a climate catastrophe. They talk about animal cruelty, and again, how farming is inherently cruel in their perspective. And they talk about health. They talk about meat giving you cancer, meat leading to premature death. And again, a lot of very egregious complaints or claims about meat consumption. It's not just groups like Mercy for Animals. As I mentioned, the Humane Society is also very active in this space. We already touched on their 15-member meatless transition team, and they are having success in this area. They've gotten companies, major food service companies, to work with them. They do trainings for chefs on putting plant products more prominently on their plates and cutting down on the meat that they serve. They're involved with military institutions, going in and providing, again, ways for the folks there to serve more plant alternatives versus having meat be a primary part of meals. So this is something that is absolutely happening. It is really out there, and it's something we all need to be aware of. So my action items for all of you, and this will set it up well for Leah as she gives you some tools and tips to take this action. The first thing is to avoid disparaging consumer choices. It's really important for us to try to listen, to understand, to try to figure out what's motivating people, why are they buying certain products, what are their concerns, are there questions we could answer, rather than resorting to frustration or mockery of the fact that there are products out there that maybe we wouldn't want to buy for our families, but others might. Focus on correcting misinformation, but don't get caught in these back and forth, round and round debates, especially if, as we look at the next point, we need to focus on interested consumers versus extremists. There is a percentage of our population, it's a very small percentage, 95% of us eat milk, meat, and eggs and are very glad to do so. But there is a very small but very vocal percentage that, again, is opposed to what we do. And there's no amount of engagement, no amount of education that's going to change their perspective, just like there's no undercover video or social media post that's going to change ours to agree with their viewpoint. So let's not waste our time. Let's not waste our energy. Let's focus on the vast majority of consumers out there who don't know a lot about animal agriculture, but also are not sensitive to animal rights issues. And those are the people we can really talk to and make sure they have correct information. And that brings me to my last point. Let's just focus our energy on positive communication. Let's focus on what do we think people need to know about animal agriculture? What facts do we wish that other people understood? And let's focus on sharing those so that when people do have choices in the grocery store or the restaurant menu, they're making them with facts and not fear and not concerns about what they might be buying, but rather confidence in the products we bring to them. So with that, I will turn it over to Leah to give you more perspective and more tips.
Hi, so I am, you're probably wondering why a dietitian is up here talking to you. I spend a lot of time in the social media space, and I navigate that for my retailer, but also professionally as a dietitian. So I really watch a lot of the conversation. So it's kind of a good ending to this, talking about what's going on with regulation, what's going on in terms of the activist organization. Now we're gonna talk a little bit more about what's going on with the consumer, or maybe we wanna talk about them as your customer or your audience. So you're probably wondering why there's this picture of a young girl up here, that's me. Back when I was in my Peggy Lipton phase, anybody remember Peggy Lipton, Mod Squad? Yeah, there you go, I'm dating myself. And with a really interesting set of glasses, shaped kind of like stop signs now that I look at them. I'm about 10 or 11 years old at the time, and I was I didn't realize I was really nearsighted. I just thought the whole world was kind of like a Monet painting, sort of like really pretty and fuzzy on the edges. And I guess my teacher pointed out to my parents that I was spending a lot of time squinting at the chalkboard. We had chalkboards, not whiteboards, and suggested I go to an eye doctor. So I got these really cool pair of glasses that I was extremely proud of for some unknown reason. And I went into school, and of course my classmates were not as similarly impressed. And I was called four eyes and, you know, you must be blind as a bat. And I came home to my mom crying, and my mom said, what all good moms do, sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can never hurt you, right? And I sat there and thought, seriously, Mom? Seriously? Because that was pretty hurtful. Like, nobody wants to be called four eyes. Nobody wants to be called blind as a bat. But what my mom said, went on to say, is, Leah, you just need to ignore them. She didn't say, you want to go in there. You want to call them names. If they call you a bad name, you call them a bad name. She didn't say that. And that's where we're at in this conversation right now. There's a lot of back and forth between what customers are hearing and what customers are saying, led by a lot of these organizations. And a lot of the people that we want to talk to and we want to reach, our audience, are getting caught in the middle of this sort of verbal barrage. So let's talk about who our audience is and who our customers are. So I think we would all agree that our audience is probably not the vegan or meat-free consumer that has very strong views about meat. And they may be based on an ethical standpoint, a moral standpoint, a religious standpoint, but whatever the reason, they don't want to eat meat products. Now, what's interesting about this percentage, and there's only about, I think the numbers vary around 5 to 7% of the American population are vegan or vegetarian. What's really interesting about that population is studies show that about 84% of them will resume eating meat. And how many of you know what the gateway meat is for vegans and vegetarians? It's bacon. So if you're producing bacon, you basically have the opioid of the meat world, right? So that is not your audience. How about the carnivore? Is the carnivore your audience? That's the Ron Swanson of the world, right? If you watch Parks and Rec, he had to be forced to eat a banana by putting it between the buns of a paunch burger, right? So the carnivore is a die-hard meat eater. That's not your customer. That's not your audience either. You don't need to persuade them to eat more meat. They're already there. What's interesting about these two really broad descriptions of customers and audience is this is not what your plant-based protein folks are after either. I sat in on a meeting or a conference up in Raleigh in December, and the Good Food Institute was there on a panel with a company that supplies startup funds for a lot of these plant-based companies, and two companies producing plant-based proteins. And they admitted that their customer is not the vegan and meat-free customer. The people they want to influence and the people that you want to influence are right in the middle. These are our just regular, typical customers. And they may refer to themselves as plant-based, but not necessarily meat-free. They may be experimenting with one meat-free meal a week for different reasons. And they may call themselves flexitarian. But overall, that customer is just curious. They may be concerned about different issues. But most of all, they really want choice, and they appreciate choice. And as Hannah said, we deserve choice. We want choice. We are not against fruits and vegetables, seeds, beans, and nuts. We want a plate that reflects a variety of choices. Why are people making decisions in the supermarket, and what are they based on? Well, they're based on a variety of different things. It's really hard to say what one thing drives a customer's purchase, because this may change throughout the course of their life. It may change week to week. It may change depending on their marital status, how many kids they have, their financial status. But these are just some of the things that can impact our decisions and the decisions of these folks that are kind of in that center of mass. Well, where can you, or where are the plant-based folks trying to affect these buying decisions? Well, price, as Eric pointed out, price is kind of all over the map, and we can see price of items, whether they're meat or the plant-based, really fluctuate. So that's not something you can really point to and hang your hat on. How about the whole idea of it being a processed item, not a whole food? Well, that's going to appeal to some customers, and some customers are frankly not going to care. So you can't really put a lot of faith in that one either. How about allergies and food sensitivities? Well, I'm going to come back to something on that, but there might be some room in there for some customers because they may have concerns about allergies and food sensitivities. How about taste? Well, taste is subjective. Like Eric said, it kind of depends how you go into a situation. Are you expecting to like the taste or dislike the taste? How about the nutrition? And I'll come back to a nutrition label on Beyond Meat. Well, you want to keep in mind that these products are basically a recipe. It's a lot easier to adjust a recipe. How about the perception? That's something I do see people pushing back on a little, especially people who tend to be more towards the vegan and meat-free side of things. They don't like the fact that these companies are trying to make things look so much like meat. Many of them don't. They don't like the fact that these are positioning themselves in the meat case alongside ground meat. How about cooking ability? Well, some people really like the fact that these are very processed and don't present any barriers to them in terms of cooking, that there's very little work to do with them. So that could be a teachable moment for people in the animal ag space. And this is where I think we really have the most opportunity is to establish faith, develop faith and trust in a brand and in a product. So let's take a look at one of the labels. And honestly, I was really interested in this because we have Beyond Meat at our retailer. And I was surprised to see how close these products were in terms of the nutritional content, because the older generation of plant-based products that we see, whether they're in the produce section or in the frozen, are not this close. So this is very surprising how close it is. What's the one thing that jumps out at you that is pretty much different? Sodium, right? But remember, this is a recipe. Their product is essentially a recipe. So if I was this company and I was getting pushback from consumers or dietitians about a slightly higher than optimal sodium amount, I'd go back to the drawing board. I'd make a reduced sodium version. So I'm saying walk away from that one. It's not that important. They can keep going back to the drawing board and they can keep changing all kinds of aspects of this because it's a recipe, it's not an individual item. It's not like they're forming pea protein or wheat gluten or anything by itself. They're adding all kinds of components to make it look, smell, taste, bleed like meat. Here are two food labels, and these are really interesting to me if you follow Michael Pollan, which I don't. Michael Pollan, one of his famous food rules is don't eat anything with more than 4 ingredients. So I wonder if this means Michael Pollan's going to walk away from the Beyond Meat burger, which is in the yellow, or he's going to embrace something with multiple ingredients like that. And from an allergy and food sensitivity standpoint, there might be some concerns for people who have certain food allergies or food sensitivity. That's going to definitely bear watching in the medical community and among board-certified allergists and dietitians, because these are a lot of products going on here. One of the ones that surprised me the most was cellulose from bamboo. Who knew? All right, who knew? And I mentioned that in a Twitter conversation, and somebody said, so what, people in Asia eat bamboo all the time? I'm like, okay, I know about pandas eating bamboo, but I didn't know beyond that. So as Hannah mentioned, we are just seeing so much, I'm seeing so much negative rhetoric on social media, and the words that are being lobbed back and forth on both sides of the aisle, and it's not by the brands. It is by these trade organizations, these marketing organizations, and a lot of times it is by really diehard fans. Sometimes if you dig deeper in these diehard fans, you see that they have connections with some of these groups. Words like clean, cruelty-free, sustainable, environmentally friendly. And on the other side of the fence, honestly, we're seeing words like fake and Frankenfood used. We used fake to get you to come to this meeting, right? Competition, I love this quote, competition brings out the best in products and the worst in people. Competition isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? Competition pushes us harder to do a better job. This is the stuff that is funny, but not great to share, right? I love this one, would be on your right. I think it was a card I saw in the supermarket or in the card store, and I shared it on social media, and some people were very highly offended at this. So we have to be very careful about some of the images and things that we share. This kind of rhetoric is bleeding out into social media, and this is an interchange that was on Facebook. The other ones were also, those were screenshots that I took from an actual Facebook conversation about Beyond Meat. So this is another one. So that use of the word fake, you're seeing that come out into the, is very prevalent right now, of course, in social media and among just the general population. So what can you do? Well, I think, and I'm not, wasn't trying to curry favor by putting up the FFA creed, but I just thought this is a really nice way to put it, that we are in a new normal. We are moving towards a very different time in food, the use of technology that you embrace on the farm. We're seeing that out on the plate as well. So what can you do to kind of embrace new and better rhetoric to tell your stories so that you can engage people and enlighten people? And it's been really interesting over this, during this conference, to see that there have been a couple sessions on this very idea, storytelling with Janice Pearson from Bayer, and yesterday the one from CFI was talking a lot about trying to engage and create trust with our customers and our audience. So focusing on words and ideas like craft and artisan and heritage, you're wanting to look at the positives of what you're doing, telling those farmer stories, talking about regenerative properties of animal agriculture, the use of technology. I have a friend who farms row crops in North Carolina, and she was telling me about the fact that her son came home, she has a five-year-old son, and he said everybody was, they were asked to draw a farm for a project in kindergarten. He said, "Mom, everybody was drawing a red barn." He said, how come our barn doesn't look like that? So that red barn mentality. So I think we need to do a better job talking about how life on the farm has changed and the use of technology has really made a lot of things possible that weren't possible 60, 80 years ago. And I saw some of the innovation areas that the Farm Bureau stations were doing yesterday, and bringing kids onto a farm, not a petting zoo, to talk about what's really going on the farm. I am not a big fan of petting zoos. I think they're fine, but that's not a way to teach kids about farming, in my opinion. Cooperation and community involvement. Again, some of the innovation ideas I thought were just amazing. Farm-to-table dinners, working with veterans, ag in the classroom. There's just some great work that's being done in your communities to try and get some of these customers who are so disconnected from what's going on in agriculture to understand more about the good things that farming is doing in the community and what farmers are doing in the community. Environmental and climate benefits. As Hannah said, boy, they are just hammering, these groups are just hammering agriculture on environmental mistakes that you're making or climate change. These issues are really important that we kind of nip those in the bud. One of the things that occurred to me when I see GFI posting all these things about how detrimental animal agriculture is I wonder to myself, okay, so if this plant-based company is building a factory to produce these plant-based products, where are they going to build it? What are they going to displace by building it? What's the environmental cost of that? What about all the raw materials to build this building? Where are the workers going to live? How are they going to get to work? Nobody's talking about that carbon footprint. Nobody's talking about the environmental cost of shipping all those products to that factory. What's happening with that waste from that factory, that plant, that manufacturing plant? And how about all the executives from these companies and these marketing firms and trade associations jetting and flying all over the world to raise money and talk about their products? What's the carbon footprint of that? Nobody's talking about that. Some of the ongoing improvement that animal agriculture has been making in antibiotic use and animal welfare issues, health and nutrition benefits of animal agriculture products, and of course, taste and recipes, because it always comes back to taste. Some of these customers will buy something once. I can tell you from working in retail for almost 20 years, they'll buy something once to try it, but if they don't like it, they'll only buy it once. OK? Okay, so you have to remember that taste and price for some customers is always going to rule. So here are just some ideas of things that you can do to kind of get the word out in a more positive way about your products and animal agriculture in general. Infographics, this is a really nice one by Chicken Check-In. One of the questions that I see a lot from customers is sort of that accusatory, well, why are chickens so much bigger now than they used to be? This explains it in a nutshell. Hannah has been an incredible resource. Animal Agriculture Alliance has been an incredible resource for me and for other dietitians to kind of tell some of these stories and to connect with some of these checkoff programs who are putting out great information like this. Encouraging farm tours and having influencers, getting in touch with influencers to tell your story. This is a lot of that I've done on my own. This is one of our tomato farmers out in Western North Carolina. This is up in Saskatchewan, a GMO canola farmer, telling those stories to people. They don't know, they don't understand. This is Bart Ramsey. He's one of our dairy farmers in Western North Carolina. He's single, by the way, if anybody is interested. He's a nice guy. And he raises dairy cows on his farm that's probably the land's been in the family for about 100 years. This is Smithfield. I took a little tour of Smithfield to see their hog barns. So what's the bottom line? It's customers want choice, and they need you to respect that they can have choice and they're entitled to choice. And them getting caught in the middle of these verbal battles is not helpful. It's not helpful for you. It's not helpful for them. And that just creates negativity, and that just creates suspicion. If you're so negative, if you're constantly bashing the other people, that's not helpful for those customers who just want to understand what's going on. They just want to sample products, they want to try something, and they just want choice. You need to tell your story. You do you. Take the high road, however you want to say it. These products are not going away. The cat's out of the bag, the genie's out of the bottle, whatever you want to say it. These products are not going to go away, but what will go away and what you can stop is the negativity and the inaccurate messages that are going out. So you can ignore, like I did when I was 10 or 11 years old, the negativity, and you can be happy about what you're doing, and you can tell people why you're proud of what you're doing and the products that you are raising, growing, and selling. Free to follow up any of us on Twitter, Facebook, anything like that. I guess it's question time. Oh, it is question time. Oh, thank you. I want to give a shout out to Scott because everybody else is thanking everybody else for coming. I appreciate you coming as well. But I came and I didn't have coffee, and Scott gave me his coffee. So he literally gave me his coffee, and he said he didn't drink any of it first, right? That's right.
Do we have any questions?
That's a tough question to start off with. I'm not a legal guy, so it's hard to answer that. I think it gets back to some of what Lee has been saying, just about the message that we push out there. I think to an extent, consumers recognize when they're being sold a story. And so, you know, if you are positive in your messaging, I think that's the most effective approach. Now, I do think there is element, as I described, for government regulatory focus on this, and that comes down to package labels and the way that those are being regulated. And it's a simple truth that the FDA does not strictly regulate what is on a package, certainly as much as we would like them to. And so if you feel strongly about what is going on packages and the way things are being marketed in that way, it's a matter of talking to your representatives and you know, pushing through channels to get that message to FDA. USDA is a little different, and USDA will not allow the claims that are currently allowed on FDA packages.
So I think it's really good and strategic to have USDA involved with this, because you've seen what happened in the dairy case. And I can tell you from a consumer perspective that most consumers don't care about that kind of language, whether it's being called coconut milk or nut juice or whatever, they don't really care. And they think that many of them just think that is sort of a waste of time for them to worry about and for us to worry about. So I think we saw that milk should have probably done that way long ago to figure out a way of kind of standing their ground on that. But I think from a customer perspective, people are going to say, unless those products are being sold in the meat case, people are going to say, well, why didn't you say anything when Boca Burger came out or turkey bacon came out? Like, why now? So it's going to be very tricky space to navigate, and I think that it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. But I wouldn't invest a lot of energy into thinking this is going to fix a situation or change the situation and make customers not want to buy something.
My question is, a lot of us in our state farm bureaus are developing policy on the definition of this style of meat. What would you recommend as a general definition of, so that we can work with our legislators to define this?
So USDA, my recommendation is USDA's definition of meat. So, and our regulatory people can quote it 9 CFR something. Our regulatory people can quote it directly, and certainly if you follow up with me, I can get you some of that information. But if you go into USDA regulations and within your farm bureaus, I'm sure some of your policy folks know how to access that. Look at USDA's definition of meat, and USDA defines meat, meat food products, and meat byproducts, and those are all kind of more specific definitions of kind of meat and what comes from animals. That is, from our perspective, the best way to approach that.
Any additional questions? All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. And if you have any additional questions for the panel, I'm sure you can catch them on the way out.